Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for having me here and having Monty here. I almost think that I should have him here. He probably could express the Dharma better than I could, actually. He's just, he's such a great dog. He's just completely himself.
And there's an empty cushion next to you.
That's right. I'm sure. Well, we'll let him do that afterwards. But I'll say a few words here to begin with. But this is my first time in Milwaukee, so it's been a great experience. Tonin took me around yesterday and gave me a really nice tour, and it's pretty amazing to see the lake there. It's like the ocean. It's hard to believe it's not the ocean.
Yeah.
You know. I guess maybe there's sort of a Dharma teaching there, actually, now that I think of it, is that you know, everything depends on our perspective, because we only have this little tiny perspective that we can see from, you know, but somebody in a helicopter or an airplane or something much higher can see that that's actually a lake. But from here on the ground, you know, our perspective is very limited, and, you know, we may interpret things according to the way we see them, but we're not seeing the whole picture often. Anyway, so that might have something to do with what I'd like to talk about this morning. And the thing I'd like to talk about is faith. It's been coming up for me a lot, it seems, in my practice. People have been asking me about faith and what it means and why do we practice and what does faith mean in Buddhism. And so I kind of want to talk about just a sort of very specific kind of faith. There's a lot that could be said on this subject, but I wanted to just talk about how we bring it into our daily life and how it expresses itself off of the cushion mainly. For example, let's say that you're in some sort of confrontation with a loved one or with a coworker or anyone. Let's say that somebody becomes upset with you and says something critical. Let's say it's a loved one. So let's say that they say things to you that they know are going to hurt you. So there's this person that's intentionally, you know, trying to hurt you, and you can see that and feel that. They say very personal things that they know are going to get a good response from you. So what is our reaction in a situation like that? And actually, we can take this to a broader scale, I think, too. What if we have a confrontation with somebody that we don't know, and for example, there's something different about that person that's different from us. So it's somebody that maybe is from a different ethnic background, or somehow we see judgments coming up according to the way that person seems to be. So there might be, say, discriminatory feelings coming up in us, or something difficult. How do we deal with that? What do we do? So, in the case of a loved one, there's probably certain habits that we might manifest. We might go into defense mode. We might get defensive. We might feel shame. We might get angry. We might know other things about this person that will hurt them. We might know what we can say to hurt them. Even if it's somebody from another ethnic background, let's say, and we feel that we've been slighted by them, we might know something we can say to really hurt them too. So we have the tools, you know, to do some harm, you know, if we want to. So in the heat of the moment, you know, this happens so quickly. How do we practice? And what exactly is going on here? In our society, unfortunately, I think the thing that we're really told to do is just, you know, an eye for an eye. If somebody does something wrong to you, so-called wrong, something hurtful or painful, you try to get them back, or there's a competition that goes on. Whoever can say the most hurtful thing or the most witty thing wins. And so you try to fight and win the argument or win the confrontation in some way. But probably all of us have discovered that that is not so reliable. It doesn't work for us. For one thing, we can't always win. And for another thing, a more important thing actually, is this is the kind of thing that leads to discrimination, suffering, war, conflict, all kinds of things that cause broad suffering in general. So most of us can see that it's a not a good strategy to take to compete, but it's very difficult in that moment. When the self arises, this is the self, you know, the self clinging to I'm right, you're wrong, you're different than I am, but my way is better and I'm right. You hurt me, so I'm going to hurt you. That's what the self does. So, here I think we're, in practice, we have to have a kind of faith not to go down our regular road of response. So if you usually say a mean thing to somebody who says a mean thing to you, that's your response. There's a way that we have to deal with that. It can be really hard not to do what you want to do, what seems like the right thing to do, the normal thing to do. But this is where the faith comes in. And we have this teaching in Buddhism of, we often call it no self, but it really means that we can't cling to anything as who we are, as this essence of who we are in our life. You know, the Buddha said, any feeling whatsoever, any perception whatsoever, any fabrications, I think he meant like a mental formation or a judgment, anything that we have as a concept, any consciousness that arises in us, whatever is past, future, or present, internal or external, blatant or subtle, common or sublime, far or near, every consciousness is to be seen as it actually is, with right discernment as it is. This is not mine. This is not myself. This is not what I am. So that's, I think, the thing, the essential thing we have faith in, that whatever we're experiencing actually is not us, and it's not the ultimate truth of the situation. Later, well, another important sutra, another important writing in Zen is the Heart Sutra. Basically says the same thing that Shakyamuni Buddha said, but it makes it a little more explicit, or it goes a little bit further. It says, there is no form, no sensation, no perception, no formation, no consciousness, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no sight, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no realm of sight, no realm of mind consciousness. So it goes so far as to say those things don't even exist, actually. Not only are they not us, but they don't exist. But I think it means this can sound, you know, very almost esoteric and strange, because we're seeing things and we're smelling things and hearing things. It does exist. It's right there in front of us. But what the Heart Sutra is saying, what Shakyamuni Buddha has said, is it doesn't exist in the way that we invest in it, because usually we cling to it and say, this is how it is, you know. This is me, or this is what I'm feeling, and this is right, or this person is there, and we have a story about them, and we make a judgment about them, and we cling to that and say that that's right and that's real. But how do we have the faith that actually our experience is not real? It's very difficult. In fact, some of us might have some resistance to this word faith in itself, because it can kind of remind us of a blind belief. I looked up the actual dictionary definition, and one of the definitions is unquestioning belief that does not require proof or evidence. Most of us don't want to think of our practice or our life, you know, as involving that kind of faith, I would think. Or there's actually another, it's the fifth definition here, complete trust, confidence, or reliance. Sixth definition, allegiance to some person or thing, loyalty. That might be coming a little bit closer to what we're talking about here in practice. Usually we think about faith as something we gain through, you know, acceptance, or something that we might be told as a child and therefore have to accept it. But in Buddhism, actually faith is connected to practice and your experience itself. And the kind of faith I'm talking about here specifically is faith in Zazen, or Zazen practice. I think that's really the key here, the faith in our Zazen. There was a great Buddhist master who used a metaphor for faith, and he used this Mani jewel, which is a famous jewel in the history of Buddhism. It has many different meanings, but he used this in a certain way. The original meaning, apparently, or the original significance of the Mani jewel was that Buddhist monks would take this jewel with them when they were wandering, and you know, they didn't have a set monastery or a set place to get food and water, so often they would have to drink out of a stream, get their water out of a stream. But it said that if you put the Mani jewel in the water that you collected, that all of the stuff in it would settle down to the bottom, all the mud and all the impure things would settle down. So it's like a purifying jewel, you know, supposedly. But Vasubandhu said, this great master said, that faith is like the Mani jewel for our mind. So we're all excited and we don't know what to do, and we have confusion, but faith, when we have faith, we can settle down and we know which direction to go. And my teacher said, he made the observation that Dogen Zenji, who was the founder of Soto Zen in Japan, a great Zen master, said that Zazen is actually the Mani jewel for us. That Zazen is the calming, or the thing in our life that gives us direction and enables us to settle down and just be here and be here right now. But how does it do this? How does Zazen do this? And I think there are basically two ways that it does that. And first, of course, let's just review, of course, what we do in Zazen. We all know we do it, but it's a very simple process, of course. But we think about it. We're just sitting here in the Zazen posture, and we're just receiving everything. Everything comes, and we're letting everything go. So usually we grasp onto what we think. We usually grasp onto our judgments about someone else. When someone hurts us, we grasp on very quickly, saying, that person hurt me, and they're wrong, and I'm right. But anything that comes up in Zazen, no matter how right we might think it is in our everyday life, we just let it go. So our zazen is kind of a way of, we're not gaining anything, we're just letting things go. It's more a process of letting go. In fact, Uchama Roshi called it opening the hand of thought. And he meant thoughts, emotions, feelings, everything. We let all of those things go. And Sawaki Roshi said, gaining is delusion, losing is enlightenment. And I think this is what he was referring to, basically, the letting go that we do in Zazen. So our practice is really not a matter of getting better at stuff in the normal sense of the word. It's a process of letting more and more stuff go, because we cling on to so many things, so many ideas that we think are right, and they impede us ultimately when we cling to them. So one of the ways that our zazen really helps us to see clearly in situations like the one I was talking about is that we're able to see the emptiness, I think, of our own body and mind. And by emptiness, we simply mean the basic teachings of the Buddha, that everything changes and everything is impermanent, and there's no substantial, permanent, fixed way of things. So everything is changing. So when we have some foundation in our life that we do every day, we settle down and we take some time to be quiet and see, or not necessarily see, but just be, we begin to see that the mind and the body are always changing. And there's no essential thing in us that's who we are, that's going to endure from one day, from one moment to the next. You know, for example, have you ever gotten up in the morning, especially if you're sitting zazen, and there's some huge issue going on, and some fear or something that seems really big, and if you reflect on it in the afternoon, you wonder what the problem was. You know, it's a completely different perspective. Often in a retreat, this will happen. We'll go into a more extended kind of time of meditation, and either before the retreat or during the retreat, some big thing comes up, like, I can't believe they did that to me. You're just chewing on some event that happened and some wrong that some person did to you, or some insecurity that you have in yourself, or some big thing that seems wrong in your life. And by the end of the sesshin, you're just wondering what all of that was about, you know. who was thinking that and why? You know, imagine if we could keep a journal of what we're thinking and feeling throughout the day, you know, and kind of just write it down. In fact, I know people who do this as a practice, that it would be quite amazing to see the fluctuations that the mind goes through. And the point is which one of those is us? Which one of those states of mind, you know, defines us? And we can see patterns, of course, and there's limitations to, the fluctuations in a certain way. But generally, it's always changing, and none of those things are the essence of who we are. But in our zazen practice, this becomes more and more apparent, especially over longer periods of time. So when anything difficult comes up, we have the faith, we understand that it's not going to last forever. It's not who we are, and we don't have to cling to it. We don't have to be so bothered by it. It's one of the ways that the faith is developed in our practice through zazen. So, of course, when we start looking at these kinds of things, we see all the different things that affect our practice and our states of mind, that what we had for breakfast this morning, the traffic, the weather. The sun comes out and everybody's happy, and, you know, going out in shorts, and it starts raining, and everybody's kind of bummed out because the picnic was canceled, or you know, the wedding has to be moved indoors, and it can, you know, the mind changes just in a moment according to conditions that we have no control over. So it's another way that we can see, I think, that we understand that we don't have one particular right perspective, and that in any given situation there isn't really one right possibility. One of the metaphors that I like in Zen a lot is that we're like a frog in a well. You know, a frog that can see a little patch of the sky, but the frog thinks that that's the entire sky. You know, now if the frog can get up just a little bit closer, or you know, we start to see that the sky is larger and larger. You know, so the process of our practice is letting go and seeing a broader and broader perspective. And realizing that we're in the well is a big part of it, you know, that our perspective is limited. So it can be hard. During the course of our practice, we see difficult things come up. We see things about ourselves that we don't like. But it's very important to accept that and to practice with it. You know, if you don't see that you're an angry, so-called angry person, nobody's an angry person. You know, that's one fault that we have, is we categorize ourselves in that way and limit ourselves. But if we don't see that we're prone to anger, for example, we have no insight when the anger comes up. So the more that we can practice with that feeling coming up, the more ability we have to let it go and to not do something unskillful in the moment. Or it might be self-deprecating. It might be judgment about yourself or someone else. It might be that you feel that you're, you know, inferior or superior. All of these things are stories about ourselves that we tell ourselves in order to have some concrete foundation of who we are that we can cling to. So feelings come up about feeling depressed, and you know, that's of course natural, but if we cling to them as the essence of who we are, it's very difficult. But if we have a little broader perspective, we understand this is a state of mind. You know, this is not who I am. So this is one sort of way that our Zazen helps our perspective. And by the way, I think this is what Dogen Zenji called, let me back up a little bit, because I'll go on to a second way that I think our Zazen really helps us, and it's a more sort of ultimate perspective, or a more universal kind of perspective. And this is what Dogen Zenji called dropping off body and mind. He said dropping off body and mind is Zazen. And basically what that means is that we let all of this stuff go. You know, the Buddha talked about all the feelings we have and all the emotions we have are not self. So, you know, in Buddhism there's five different categories that the Buddha talked about. The five skandhas, the five aggregates. But basically those are all the body and mind. You know, four are mind and one is body. But so when Dogen Zenji talked about dropping off body and mind, he was talking about dropping off those five aggregates, or those five skandhas. The Heart Sutra talks about, you know, those are empty. And so we're not clinging. You know, we're not clinging to any of those aspects of the body or the mind. And it sounds kind of weird too, you know. We get a feeling like we're dropping off body and mind, so you're just kind of what? You're wandering around in this nebulous.
You're a ghost.
You're a ghost, right, you know. But again, it's the clinging. Of course, we have a body and mind. But you know, ultimately, they're not what we think they are. We cling to them as real and essential to who we are. But the problem is the clinging. You know, it's not the experience of having a body and mind. So, so in that moment, when someone calls you a name, or you have some judgment come up about somebody, or some judgment about yourself, we can allow our Zazen practice to inform us, you know, in that moment, the dropping off body and mind, you know, dropping off the judgments as they come up, you know, not shutting them out or saying it's wrong, you know, not tamping it down, or but just letting it come through us. And you know, in the Heart Sutra, it says, without any hindrance, there is no fear. You know, a bodhisattva relies on prajna paramita, or ultimate wisdom. But we're sort of stifled and separate from that ultimate wisdom if we're clinging to some judgment about ourselves or someone else. So this, you know, this dropping off body and mind, I think, manifest in our life is letting go, and we have much more possibility for making a good response, so to speak. Although good's, you know, another concept, but an appropriate response. So I don't know, we can't say what that response always is. But it's probably not, you know, calling the other person a name or punching them in the mouth. You know, it's probably it's probably not the best response, but that might be our habit pattern. So until we can understand and let go of the habit pattern, we can be stuck. But to let go and allow that prajna, that wisdom, to be there and to allow us to have some more clarity is much more a much more wholesome way, you know, of dealing with these kinds of situations, I think. So I should stop soon, but one thing I'll say also, another thing I'd like to say about faith and Dogen Zenji's teachings is, you know, usually in Buddhism and in most practices, spiritual practices, or many, we have we think there's a process of sort of developing faith or developing our practice. In fact, in Japanese, there's a very traditional phrase called, you know, it's Monshi Shusho. It's hearing, thinking, practicing, verification. So we hear the teaching, and we think about it, take it in, we practice it, we do it, and then there's the verification in our life of that practice. You know, we bring it in through doing it. And, you know, this shusho in Japanese is often translated as satori, or in the English word is often spoken of as just enlightenment, but there are actually several words for enlightenment in Japanese. But this particular one, verification, was very important, I think, to Dogen Zenji. And the, you know, the famous phrase of his teaching is shusho ichinyo, practice and verification are one. So I think this is very important, and there's much that can be said about it, of course, but the most important part for this talk is, I think, in relation to that moment when we're faced with our own suffering and the sufferings of others, and we let go, and there is some alternate response. That in itself is enlightenment. You know, that is the verification, you know, itself. So we want to live an enlightened life. We want to have enlightened activity in our life. We do it here and now, you know, or it's done. That's another thing. We can't really do it. We have to just let go and let it be done, it, you know, includes us, but, you know, we can't really do it ourselves. That's a whole other talk, but, you know, in that moment when wholesome practice manifests, we have the verification there. Our suffering isn't there. In any particular moment, we let go, and that's the end of suffering for us in that moment, and maybe for others too. The hard part is in the next moment, it might be back again. So, you know, it's not a one-time, this dropping off body and mind is not some kind of one-time experience where we go through some big thing and then we're okay and we don't have to try anymore. Dogen Zenji was, he didn't pull any punches or didn't give us any break. He said, you've got to just keep doing it over and over and over in every moment. But the beautiful part is that any moment is open to a complete and perfect enlightenment. Any moment we are free to be liberated with all beings in our practice. But I think this is a direct connection to our Zazen effect. This is our Zazen working in our daily life. And so it's why it's important for us to understand that our Zazen practice is the center of everything we do. You know, it's not really... For me, it can't be just something I do on the side to kind of help me out. It's something that gives me guidance. It's something that allows me to live in a way that is wholesome. It's not that I bring Zazen into my life, but I do Zazen, and this is my aspiration. I do Zazen and hope that that Zazen will be my life and manifest my life for me, guide me in my life. For these kinds of reasons, that we can let go of our fixation, you know, on our patterns, our habit patterns, and our judgments and biases and our difficulties. So this faith is a kind of fearlessness that we have to let go in any particular moment of who we are. You know, completely let go of who we are. But when we let go, we have this verification there. That's this enlightenment, this prajnaparamita. Okay, let's just see if there's anything else I really wanted to say. There's one other point that I think is important, and Dogen Zenji actually emphasized this, and I'll just briefly mention it, and perhaps maybe the best way to sum it up is to quote something from a Rinzai master, actually. A student asked the Zen teacher Soen Nakagawa during a retreat, I'm very discouraged. What should I do? He said, encourage others. That was his answer. Encourage others. And Dogen Zenji really emphasized this, that you know, so much of our problem is being wrapped up in our own world. What can I do to get out of this? My perspective this, my perspective that. But if we're focused on helping a broader community, helping others, the focus on our own suffering is released, you know, actually. And I happen to believe, actually that a human being is really an animal or a creature that is most fulfilled when it's feeling that it's in service of others. Or if we look at the Buddha, he was the prime example. He attained so-called enlightenment at the age of 35, 36. And the rest of his life, for 40 or 45 years, he walked across ancient India teaching people, begging for his food and receiving only what he was given. But we look to him as, you know, sort of the ultimate of the human being. He just gave everything he had. And that's kind of, you know, the ideal, I think, that we can look up to as someone giving, you know, every moment. But of course, most of us have a ways to go before we reach that kind of level of practice. But we can do it in any particular moment, any particular situation, by trying to step outside and broaden our view, you know, from the well, and see what needs to be done for someone else. And Dogen Zenji wrote in one of his chapters of the Shobo Genzo, which is his great writing, one of his great writings. He said that the so-called ultimate stage of enlightenment refers to the awakening of the fruit of Buddhahood. But when we compare Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, the complete enlightenment of the Buddha, with first arousing Bodhi mind, the first time that we aspire to awakening, if we compare those, they're like the kalpani and the fire of a firefly. The kalpani is the conflagration at the end of a world system, and, you know, in sort of classical Buddhism. So the end of the universe, there's a fire. So he's saying, when we, by regular terms, compare those two things, you know, the Buddha's enlightenment and our aspiration, our first aspiration of bodhicitta, we call it, it's like comparing the end of the universe, the fire at the end of the universe, to a firefly. You know, there's so much difference. However, when we arouse the mind of ferrying across others before ourselves, and this ferrying across means, this is a classic, you know, way of talking about enlightenment. You know, you go from this shore of suffering to that shore of non-suffering, you know, samsara to nirvana. But he says that when we arouse the mind of ferrying others across before ourselves, helping others to be awake before ourselves, that these two are not different, that our own awakening and the awakening of the Buddha are the same. So he says over and over again that that kind of attitude is much harder to express or cultivate than, you know, the grand enlightenment of the arhats, or, you know, complete perfect sainthood, whatever we want to call it. That the heart of helping others before yourself, or with yourself, as yourself, you know, not discriminating, is the highest, you know, is the highest form of practice. So sorry, I've gone over a little bit longer than I think I was supposed to.
There's no supposed to.
Okay, all right. But I think that's all I'll say about this. And usually here we see if there's any comments or anyone had to make, or any questions about
questions, things they'd like to add, whatever.
We have to go on now. Thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thank you. I think I'm always amazed at nature and how nature is wise and full of instruction. But when you were talking about how we get full of our own attitudes and judgments and all that stuff and carry it, but it made me think about daytime is like action, you know, everything is kind of out there, and then night comes and it's a time of rest, do you know? And so it's, you know, it's set up like that so that we can let go and sleep and rest, mm-hmm. and recover and rejuvenate. Unfortunately, there is a major problem with insomnia now. Because we don't let go. Yeah. We carry that, and yeah. we can't sleep, and we get anxious, and, you know. But really, it's all, I mean, it's set up so beautifully. You know, you work during the day, you get into trouble, and then when night comes, you let it go and you rest. And then the next day is brand new.
Right.
Or a wave. Do you know a wave comes in and it's full of stuff? It crashes, and then it goes away. I mean, it's everywhere. I just love that. Do you know what I mean? Like, how nature is such a grand teacher.
Yeah, that's right.
The metaphor of, you know, for how to be better.
Yeah.
But you have to notice and pay attention, you know.
Yeah, the letting go. Yeah, we really let go when we're asleep. We use all that stuff for let go. And of course, sooner or later, we all have to let it all go.
Yeah.
You know. And so our practice, in a way, is sort of being okay with that. I think just coming to that point where we can be okay with the fact that we're impermanent. Yeah, I mean, it's a cool thing that sort of every day we have this rhythm, and you know, we just go back to just non-thinking. And there was a Zen teacher that I think sort of described the importance of doing Zazen for a training person, somebody's training, in terms of that, like. They're saying that, you know, it's sort of a metaphor that the day we wake up and we do Zazen, you know, we do all of our stuff during the day, and then we do Zazen again in the end of the day. And he was talking about that in terms of like sort of life. We come from whatever, emptiness, this darkness that we don't know about, you know, and then we do a lot of stuff, we're really busy, we wear a lot of different clothes, as Sawaki Roshi said, we fulfill a lot of roles, but then we have to let go at the end again. Mm-hmm. So he was saying it was important to sort of bracket our day by Zazens, because we're just starting out from emptiness, so-called emptiness, and doing activity, and then going back to emptiness, and the day is sort of a rhythm like that.
Yeah.
That's right. That's very good, thank you.
Sawaki also had a wonderful saying that I find I repeat to myself a lot. It had to do with sort of the end of his commentary on the Song of Awakening, and he says, "Don't look at the starry heavens through a straw."
Right.
And it's like the frog in the well, but I love it because if it's through a straw, I could put it down.
Right.
And as soon as you start putting, you know, start moving it away, the whole heavens are there.
That's right.
So it's a lovely saying.
Yeah, that's a great.
But like you were saying in the beginning about Lake Michigan, I mean, it looks so vast and majestic, but actually, it's actually much smaller than an ocean.
Right.
You know what I mean? So that's like the opposite. You know, the from a different perspective, it's much smaller.
Yeah.
Even though from when you're just looking at it, it's enormous.
Yep.
It's, you know.
It's one way that sort of, you know, modern science is helpful in a way to show us that there's always a different perspective. We're seeing stuff that we've never been able to see before on the small end of the scale, too. You know, there's whole worlds that we never imagined were there before. But basically the teaching is that there's always another perspective, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And we just realize all the time that the perspectives are infinite. There's always a different way to see things. We think we know the right way, you know, we have the right perspective, but there's always another way to see something. Yeah.
Tolson has a real early newsletter, and you probably are looking at those, I know, where he talks about how we have these limits, and we think we're so limited, and the whole little two-page story is, you know, just kind of about that, but he often uses the word boundless and how really the limitations are just in your head, and really, you know, it's this, you have these boundless options. And I've always loved that boundless word that Tozen would use often in his newsletters. It just makes you feel so free of, you know, whatever is bothering you, and you feel like, you know, this is something that's going to just hold me here and trap me here.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's interesting because it's another play on words. If something is boundless, it has no boundaries.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. So boundaries don't exist in a boundless world. Yeah. Yeah, well, they kind of opening up.
Right. And yet they're really important. It's yes. important to establish boundaries and relationships and, yeah. you know, yeah. so, yeah. you know.
That's right. Yeah.
Anything else we have here? Okay.